You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for joining us this afternoon at Brookings. It's great to see you all. My name is Johannes Lin. I'm a non-resident senior fellow at the Global Economy and Development Program here at Brookings, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you all this afternoon to participate, and really stresses on participate, in a discussion exchange on what is a very important topic, I believe, namely agricultural development, smart investing for global food security. If you don't know what is meant by smart investment, fear not, because that's my principal question, or one of my principal questions to the panelists who will be with us this afternoon, are with us this afternoon. And indeed, it's a very distinguished group of panelists that we are happy to have here. Let me start with Gilbert Humbo, who is to your far right. Gilbert will lead off, and with a discussion, he is the president of the International Fund for Agricultural Development, also known as IFAD, in Rome. He has been president of IFAD for just about a year now. He was appointed, or took on his role, his office there in April 2017. In terms of his background, by the way, there, I believe you all might have seen the CV, so I'll be very brief, but give you just the essence of what I think is his background. Correct me if I'm wrong, Gilbert. So he started off his professional career in the private sector. He then spent a number of years, including senior positions at UNDP. He served as prime minister for his country, the Republic of Togo, for 4 years, 2008 to 2012. And before joining IFAD, he was the deputy director general for the ILO in Geneva. So we will first call on you. But before I do so, Gilbert, let me introduce next to him Karen Brooks, who is a director at the Consultative Group for International Agricultural Research, also known by the somewhat difficult acronym CGIAR. She has a distinguished academic career, and spent more than 20 years at the World Bank, especially in Africa, where she worked particularly on agriculture and rural development. And third, last not least, Julie Howard, who is the senior advisor to the associate provost and dean at Michigan State University. Today, what's particularly relevant, I think, for us is that she served as the first chief scientist in the Bureau of Food Security at USAID, and was a key player in developing Feed the Future, which you may know as USAID's flagship initiative on food security. She also has had a career in academia and an important food security-related NGO. So these are three wonderful panelists. I really thank you all for joining us today. But before I go on, before you get into substance, very important, there will be a reception after we're done here at 5 o'clock, roughly at 5 o'clock outside. So I hope you all join us, and our panelists will also be there. And to the extent you couldn't answer your questions or you didn't want to raise your questions in a public context like this, you want to do it privately, you can catch them afterwards. So please stay on for the reception when we finish. Which reminds me, we don't have a lot of time, so let's move right into the discussion. And as I hope we'll have an exchange, I'll first address sort of my question, and in that sense I'm privileged perhaps as a moderator here, to each of the three of our panelists. We'll see whether there's a follow-up that is could be helpful. We'll then throw it open for all of you. Let me already note now, when we turn the microphone over to you, please introduce yourselves. It's very helpful to all of us to know who we are, and we've introduced ourselves, so please introduce yourselves. But with that, let's get started. Gilbert, so IFAD, for those of you who don't know, is a UN agency, but also a multilateral international financial institution, and works at the intersection of agriculture, rural development, nutrition, and, in a sense, supporting it all, food security. So maybe you could tell us from your perspective, at IFAD, why should we actually care about food security and all these other related issues? Does IFAD, sort of what are the critical dimensions of IFAD's support for smart investment, whatever you would help us understand that to be? And finally, why should I, as an American taxpayer, for that matter, whoever is an American taxpayer in this room, why should we call on our members of Congress to support IFAD with appropriations and in any other ways? Why should I go out and write to my congressman to support you guys? So with that as three easy questions, what do you think?
Thank you so much, Ioannis, and thank you for having us here today. As a matter of fact, it's quite a tricky question. From IFAD perspective, I would say that we have to start by looking at the SDG, the Sustainable Development Goals. And if you look at SDG 1 and 2, then look at what it takes. Today is estimated hundreds of billions of investment if we want to achieve SDG 1 and 2. And that are huge amounts. So to do that, one has to be smart and invest smartly. I hope that answers part of your question. But more importantly, I think in today's environment, from IFAD perspective, investment in agriculture, you have to see it, first of all, as a matter of national security. Food security is a critical, I think, is almost number one in terms of national security. Secondly, beyond the humanitarian side of it, which we can easily, all of us can agree, the case we are making in IFAD is a long-term investment. It's not just a matter of food security. It's also a matter of bringing back through a genuine rural transformation, bringing back the youth to feel comfortable in practicing agriculture as a way of life, as a way of earning decent income, instead of looking at this as a last resort career. What does that entail in terms of implementation? It means that not only for us in IFAD, we are really focusing on the women because of for the economic rationale, not just a matter of principle, but also from the economic rationale, it's better to focus on the women in the rural area. But doing it by coupling it with the climate change and the environment dimension, the climate smart agriculture. You mentioned the nutrition, which is quite critical. And finally, focusing on mainstreaming also the youth. We do believe that when you take those four parameters and you mainstream them in an environment where you bring also the more and more the private sector to change the mindset, as I mentioned before, not looking at the agriculture just as a surviving, but so that will really help us move in the right direction in achieving the SDGs. It's important to keep in mind, if you take Africa, for example, today, according to the Africa Development Bank report, we still have $35 billion a year of food-related imports. And that 35 million will grow to 100 million if nothing is done in the next 10, 15 years by 2030. At the same time, we know that the potential are there, 25% of arable land in the world. The irrigation level is quite very low, which means there's a room for improvement. So I would like to argue that it is time for us to thinking more on the long-term investment. And just to finish quickly this introductory remark, let's take a little bit the agriculture, the health sector. We all have seen when we have the Ebola crisis, in the Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, we know the costs that the world has to spend to eradicate the crisis, and partially, or if not almost, because of lack of long-term investment to start with. So it's not to create a panic, but what I mean here is that investing in the long-term agriculture, in farm and non-farm activity, what IFA does, is essential for the long-term food security and therefore national security.
Thank you. Great. That starts us off, I think, very effectively, but we may come back and ask a couple of follow-up questions. But let me then turn to Karen. So from your perspective at CGIAR, but maybe also more broadly, your background, World Bank and academia and so on, how do you see smart investment? What can help us perhaps understand what we mean by that? What is the role from your perspective of external actors like CGIAR, the World Bank, IFAD and others, USAID? How are they contributing? And what do we sort of collectively need to do better to actually contribute to food security and the other good things, rural poverty reduction, agricultural productivity growth, and so on?
Those are a lot of questions.
Six and a half minutes.
they're wonderful questions, but I want to pick up on one of the comments that President Humbo put before us, and that's the importance of young people. And I'll get to that, but I want to focus on youth and youth employment, and I expect that Julie may actually be saying a little bit about that as well. I want to do that actually by way of focusing on agricultural research and the role of productivity growth. And I'll start by recognizing that we're basically at a 10-year anniversary. It's 2018. In 2008 and 9, everybody got really excited about food security because food prices spiked up, and they had been perceived as somewhat low before that, and there was tremendous concern about food security, about feeding the world, focusing toward 2050, how are we going to feed 9.5 billion people, and concern about the prices. Now, actually, it's 10 years later, and what we tend to hear about is not so much high prices and prices spiking, but if you just look at the American press, you see about, you know, low cereal prices. There's really very little concern and emphasis on food price issues. But if you look at the FAO price index, actually, the index now is approximately at the same level that it was in 2008. We have high prices, and prices are projected, according to our models and most of the models that I know of, they're projected to be going up even more by 2030 and 2050. And so we do have an issue of how are we going to provide affordable food to 9.5 billion people in 2050 and in the intervening years as well. Now, the way we have done that in the past, we've had a model in the back of our minds, and it's been one that has served us well for understanding history. But I think a smart investment now means that we have to revisit that and understand how the future might be different from the past. Now, that story that we told in the past was that we invested in agricultural research. Agricultural research led to productivity growth, which led to lower food prices, which in turn led to creation of opportunities for job creation in manufacturing, labor-intensive manufacturing, in the services. So people had an opportunity to move out of agriculture because there were jobs being created by the low food prices, and there was, you know, tremendous poverty reduction, there was reduction in hunger. All of this happened in the mindset of this historical approach to agricultural research, productivity, structural transformation, job creation, and a lot of good things that happened afterwards. Now, I think that's a very good way to understand the past, and to some extent, it's still serving us, and it's still an operative model. But I think where we have to understand the change now is that that link through structural transformation is no longer as strong as it was before. And so investment in agricultural productivity, which brings down prices globally, is not going to have the same effect in creating labor-intensive manufacturing in places where the labor force is growing very rapidly. So when we look at the places where we have the youth bulge, tremendous growth in the cohort of people between the age of 15 to 24 who are entering the labor force, where are they going to find jobs? In the past, those low food prices that were produced from global productivity growth anywhere in the world were filtered into the local economy, created jobs off the farm, and people could move into them. Now, where we have a weaker link between global food prices and job creation in manufacturing and services, it means that those global food prices are not going to do the same job in job creation that they did in the past. And that means that for the young people entering the labor force in countries that are predominantly dependent on agriculture and that will be dependent on agriculture in 2030 and 2050, although to a somewhat lesser degree, that means that the productivity growth has to take place in those countries. We heard about the growth in imports, the space where local production can move into those imports. Young people can be employed on farms to create food for local and for regional consumption. But that will only happen now if the productivity growth takes place in those countries, not if it takes place across the ocean, because it's not going to have the same job-creating effect. So I think the point that I'd like to make is that we have to look at food systems. We have to look at our investment in food systems as something that creates food, affordable food, but that also creates jobs, and jobs where people need the jobs. And that's where EFED comes in. Because those countries where, you know, millions of young people are moving into the labor force that need to be employed in agriculture, those are EFED member countries and borrowing countries. And EFED works with them on the agricultural productivity agenda. EFED finances investment in agricultural research and productivity. And EFED is able to work with local partners and to advocate for it. But EFED can't do it alone. There has to be a major commitment of the countries to look at their own productivity, their own agricultural sectors, and to get the job done themselves with the help of EFED. And I'm concerned that we're not seeing that enough. And so I try to ring alarm bells anytime I have a chance to sit in a chair like this one and say we have to have much more emphasis on agricultural productivity growth in the places where it's lagging most now, because that's where it's going to be needed. So I have a somewhat less concern than President Humbo does about the attractiveness of agriculture for young people. But rather, I have concern that they're simply it's not that they won't want to go into agriculture. Mm-hmm. They'll have to go into agriculture, and there has to be a very productive agriculture that can serve their needs.
Great. Thanks very much, Karen. Actually, I think we may have the beginning of a good discussion here with everybody else in the room also, because the focus on youth is something I want to come back to with Gilbert and give him a chance, because under his leadership in the last replenishment, the focus on youth moved very much to the forefront of EFED's strategic concerns, and we can perhaps come back to that. And we'll see whether there are differences of perspectives on this. But Julie, Karen thought you might want to say something about that topic, and please do, because I think it may be a defining sort of question for us. But maybe you can also say something about, sort of from your perspective working with USAID, maybe also from your perspective now as sort of an independent observer in a sense of the scene, what's the complementarity of these various agencies, that whether it's EFAD, whether it's USAID's Feed the Future, whether it's the World Bank's work, Asian Development Bank, African Development Bank, I mean, there's so many operating that space. Are we actually doing enough from your perspective and your experience to bring these together into some kind of common common effort so that we're really scaling up because we partner with each other and have an impact that really is larger than the sum of our individual efforts? So if you can start a little bit on this, because I also wanted to push Gilbert perhaps a bit more on that.
So I'll return to your second question.
Good.
But the short answer is no, we're not doing enough.
Okay.
And yes, I will talk about youth, and happy to that President Humbo started us off on this. But I wanted also to say what I think smart investment in agriculture is, and reiterate that smart investment is smart investment not only for global food security's sake, but for national and global security. Very, very important, and I think youth has very much to do with that. Smart investment, I also think, takes into consideration what's the context that we're living in now, and how are things changing. And Karen, I think your comments are very instructive on that, and I agree with most of them, maybe not all of them. But just to put some numbers on, We're really going through some incredible demographic changes in the world right now. I mean, it's just, you know, we know the current population figures are going up to 9.7 billion by 2050. But we think about the geographic distribution of population is also changing. Right now, Africa has 13% of global population. By 2050, it's going to have a quarter. And by 2050, half of the world's population growth is going to be concentrated in 9 countries globally. 5 of them are going to be in Africa. So to me, smart investment means really laser focus, large focus on Africa. The other thing is, President Hongbo alluded to this, in sub-Saharan Africa, populations are very, very young. 200 million right now between the ages of 15 to 24, and that's going to double by 2045. So we've got a preponderance of population going to be in Africa. They're predominantly young, and as Karen said, the formal job market is just not keeping up at all. And right now, the figures for un- and underemployed youth are staggering, 60%, double unemployment rates for adults. So it's a double-edged sword, right? I mean, on one hand, this is a generation that has had increased access to school. So if harness is a bad word to put for youth, but if channeled, that's better. If channeled, you know, they could be a driving force for transformation of these economies. But on the other hand, you know, and especially in the more fragile countries, not channeled, you know, they are increasingly, I think, a threat to stability. And we're seeing that in places like northern Nigeria. A poll that my colleagues at Michigan State carried out a couple of years ago found that in 34 countries of sub-Saharan Africa, the citizens said that unemployment was their number one concern. And for youth who have joined and then left rebel movements, most of them say, we joined because we had no economic options. So it's very, very scary. So what does that have to do with agriculture? Well, I think the agri-food system, agreeing with Karen, presents opportunities for youth employment. But at the same time, the food system is transforming very, very rapidly in sub-Saharan Africa. So some of it is on-farm opportunities, but increasingly the opportunities are off-farm. And I believe, you know, switched on-farm activities will be of interest to youth, you know, sort of tractor service or, you know, things to do with ICT. Not, you know, when I speak with youth, they want nothing to do with the hand hoe agriculture. They see how it's broken their parents and grandparents. They want something new. But increasingly, there are opportunities off-farm. And why is that happening? Well, incomes are going up. Urbanization is increasing very rapidly in all 3 continents, Asia, Africa, and in Latin America. And consumer demand, tastes are transforming. You can only eat so much cereal. So demand for things like fish and poultry and oil seeds, for things for processed food, demand for prepackaged, semi-processed and processed foods, demand for food eaten away from home is increasing. And it's in those areas of the value chain that I think that's like a gold mine for us right now. And it's largely hidden. Those opportunities that youth could seize, as well as other small and medium scale entrepreneurs, to do that wholesale job, to do that retail job, to do that fancy packaging that you need for vegetables going to supermarket or to local market. Those opportunities are there, and that's different. You know, that's been a big change in sub-Saharan Africa, I think, over the past decade. The systems that we have right now are not friendly for youth to take up those opportunities. They're not. Access to credit, especially if you're a young woman, where's your land? Sorry, you know, the cultural traditions augur against a young woman having land. Finance, transport difficulties, training programs. I've been involved in developing a program at Michigan State where we went out and talked to private sector potential employers or potential contractors. How are the training programs? How do you find the youth? I said, please don't send me anybody from colleges. Don't send me anybody from a polytechnic. They don't have the skills that I need, and they come equipped with attitude. You know, I need to pay them, even though I have to train them to do what I need them to do. So we've got a big job to sort of reprogram our policies to make them more welcoming and accessible, finance, land, training programs for youth. And we've got quite a job, you know, to turn things around fairly quickly, a very short time fuse for this growing youth population. And Johannes, just quickly on your last question, are we working together? No. I think this is a kind of wicked problem. I also think it's a wicked opportunity. For the same program that we were working on designing, we used to go to the Nigerian government and say, look, we're working on this. What do you think? We're training 10,000 youth in your state. Isn't that great? And their faces fell. 10,000 is a big number for a university to train. They said, 10,000, only 10,000. That is a drop in the bucket compared to the need that we have. I said, okay, we'll consider this as a pilot. So just amazing. But it shows the scale of the problem, and it shows the importance of all of us, you know, to do a really traumatic step change in how we think about. We cannot any longer have the luxury of going incremental pilot project by incremental pilot project to solve this kind of wicked problem, you know, the transformation of a food system that's inclusive of youth and young women. We have to work together. There has to be incentives in place by management, senior managers. There has to be involvement by local stakeholders.
Thanks, Julie. So I think we put a lot of issues on the table. Let me come back to Gilbert, if I may, with actually those sort of, in a sense, the same two questions where I ended up with Julie. One on youth. So I know it's maybe a bit unfair because you've only recently started, sort of as an institution at least, to explicitly focus on youth. But are there any early thoughts that you might have that you can share? Also, especially bouncing off what you've heard from Karen and Julie, of where you think you want to take this and where you see the opportunities for IFAD. But also maybe say a little bit about how you see the scale issue that Julie ended up with. Is, you know, so it's great to do a good little project, and you do lots of good little projects in my experience. But is there a way to translate a good project, a good pilot, actually into something that leads to impact at scale, whether it's provincial or national, or maybe even international, cross-national scale? So maybe on those two things, if you can share your thoughts a bit more, and then I think we'll throw it open, if that's okay.
Thanks, Johannes. If I come back to the issue about the youth, I'm very glad it's at the center of the discussion. I'll just reinforce or reiterate what Karen was saying in terms of the productivity dimension. Is going to be crucial. You see, the heart of the matter, today if you look at the youngsters in the rural area, I am convinced that even they are not looking at getting exactly the same thing as in the big cities. If they can get reasonable, decent income with what I call a minimum social services, basic social services. And in social services, obviously, I include the technology dimension. If they are able to have their WhatsApp working in the, you know, with the connectivity, if they access the into the feeders road, access to the big cities are relatively easy, they can go back and forth. They will think twice before deciding to be in the slum in the big city than being in the rural area. So the hardship of agriculture, you have to take that into account. And therefore, the solution for me is technology, is the productivity where it matters, not across the Atlantic. And I believe Karen's point, we can't underestimate that dimension. So what do we do? What are we doing in IFADs? We also talk about the access to credit and all the rural finance issue that we have. So what we are doing, we have launched what we call the ABC, the Agribusiness Capital Fund. The objective here for IFAD is to, in addition to our current portfolio, which is a sovereign loan, we serve the communities, but through loan to the government. So what we want to do to complement that, to be able to finance directly the youngsters for projects that are below $1 million and as low as $50,000 or $100,000, with a technical assistance facility helping them to put together bankable projects. So we do believe that and the first, we expect by the end of the year to be able to do the first loan in that context. So for us, it will be that concrete contribution to the magnitude of the problem on the youth. It's going to also be important in looking at the youth dimension, not only from the, I will agree with you, not only from the on-farm, but also off-farm activities. It's quite important. And looking at the off-farm activities, even though we are serving the rural area, we also have to be quite mind open how we define. If you are struggling to define smart investment, I will also say that it's not obvious to define a rural area. And the more we look at it, the more you have the second level, the third level of cities that are mushrooming around the world, the suburban area becomes also an element of investment, of that smart investment that I will include in my definition of rural area. So the definition itself of rural area, certainly not the big cities, but it's not also the traditional definition, especially if you want to target the youth. Linked to the youth, I just cannot help it, but by bringing in here the whole debate on the migration and the refugee dimension. We have a project in Senegal that we put together a scheme where the returnees from Libya, from Mediterranean neighboring countries like Italy or Southern Europe will go through a training and identify bankable projects that we help them put together and can be on or off-farm activity, and quite very successful, is picking up much more than we expect, and in the rural area. You see, so for us, this, what we are discussing about is also part of the solution for the migration to if you really want to keep migration a choice rather than a last resort solution that we see in our youngsters. Then, looking at that from the scale up that you are talking about, and again, I talk about the magnitude of the investment that I require if we were to achieve SDG 1 and 2. So to me, there's absolutely no way to get to that ambition, that target, if we are not smart or smarter in scaling up the success stories. And that had to start from the time you are preparing, you are conceiving your project. You have to, at the beginning, thinking about what is going to happen at the end of the project, and also be very systemic in the during the midterm reviews or the MNEs during the whole life the cycle of the project. And at the end, we are developing right now in IFAD what we call our knowledge center. And one of the objectives is to be able to systematically collect those success stories. And those success stories is not only IFAD. And again, it's quite important to keep in mind that we cannot do it alone. I believe Julie was reminding us on that. So once you have collected those success stories, looking at others in addition to IFAD, that can also help in scaling up what we have done. And also, IFAD to also be ready to scale up success story that others have experimented, and including the results of the research centers. Very often we have a very good result done and then piloted, but we are not picking it up enough, at least from what I said. I was just having a long discussion a month ago with Africa Rice, for example, trying to see how we can really use the opportunity, but also assisting them. One dimension which I believe is important when you talk about scaling up is also more and more. You see, the traditional way of doing development, where you put the project or the program approach, then you go through it 5, 6, 7 years down, the project is over, everything's back to kind of square one. We really need to make sure that we put an end to that. So for us, the challenge, the real sustainable scale-up, is when the government picks up the good success stories. And I was, literally a week ago, last Wednesday, I have the official representative of Indonesia that was telling us what they need from IFAD now. They want us not necessarily making loans from IFAD, getting loans from IFAD, but together with them, having a review about the past 10 years, we know there have been a lot of success stories where they are ready themselves to embed that in the national budget to scale up those activities. So having the government picking up what has worked and also sharing it at the sub-regional level with other countries in the sub-region or in the continent. So what has, and the last point, though, scaling up, when I talk about the continent, I also cannot help it by thinking about the South-South perspective. So sometimes what has worked in the Philippines, being able for us to copy that and implement that in Ethiopia or implement that in Honduras, for example.
Great. Thank you very much. Let's throw it open now. Who would like to? I see one hand. Two hands, okay, three hands. Let's take these first. The microphones will be coming to you, and please introduce yourselves. And if you have specific questions to any of the panelists, by all means, tell them.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for your presentation. My name is Rosemary Seguero. I'm a president of a profit and non-profit company called Hope for Tomorrow. Sequeros International Group. We focus on the rural areas. Julie, happy to see you. I've seen Julie since long time ago talking about agriculture. I'm still here talking about agriculture. So my question and comment is, we just finished the World Bank IMF annual spring meetings talking about this again, agriculture. But we come next again in annual meeting, the same thing. Nothing is happening because they are giving the money to the government. So when they give the money to the government is not giving money to the local people like rural area. They don't even want to hear about rural area at all. So because we're looking at government, public sector, civil society, community, pest and farmers, there is no collaboration, there is no coordination, there is no information. Nobody knows who is doing what. So we have always, especially I come from Kenya, when we talk about farmers, you're talking something you don't know. It's just like, so we are talking here about IFAD. Nobody in Africa or rural area know about IFAD, because IFAD would be talking to the government. I'm a civil society, I'm not on the table. So if I'm not on the table, I don't know. And the farmer even doesn't even understand. So now that IFAD is here, experts are here, Julie is here, and Brookings. So how do we make this happen? Can you put me on your table so that I can represent the civil society? I take the message and to the farmers and the really people who are actors of the agriculture. When we talk of agriculture, it's not in town. Agriculture food is grown in the rural areas. Women like me have grown on the ground. You can see my hands here, taking with a hoe, not a scooter or anything. So how do we sit with you guys on the table and see that what you are saying really will happen? Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much. That really kicked us off well. Thank you. Over here to the...
Yeah, I'll try to be brief. My name is David Henson. I'm a partner in Brookland Capital. My question is, for anyone who wants to answer, Julia Joubert, what is the role of equity investing in the food chain or the food security supply chain? What's interesting is that you have debt investing, and whether it's the World Bank, IMF, there's always debt investing, loans. You never talk in terms of equity investing. And how would the role of equity investing influence the ability to move more young people as private business owners into the food supply chain?
Great. That's, thank you very much. And then there was a question over here.
Hi, Dave Ramaswamy with Indus Latin Ventures. I've worked for a year in rural Ethiopia, so my question comes from that perspective. In Ethiopia, I was shocked to see in the capital instant coffee imported from Singapore and strawberry jam imported from Dubai. And these Singapore and Dubai don't grow coffee or strawberries. So, and then the it becomes, the reason is why. And it turns out there's like tax policy implications, and the bigger issue is energy, access to stable energy supplies and infrastructure to store and process food. So my question is, how do you ensure all future multilateral funding in Africa or rural Latin America in energy or infrastructure has an agricultural component? Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Yes, let's take one more question, and then I'll give back so they don't lose track, and then we'll come towards the back there.
Thank you. My name's Barbara Day. I was formerly with
the
Overseas Private Investment Corporation. And I wonder if you could, sort of following on this question, give a couple of examples of what you think were really good bankable projects that the private sector can be involved in supporting the agriculture sector.
Thank you very much. Let me turn it back then to Gilbert. A lot of the questions actually around the sort of private sector engagement. You had gave a little bit of a taste of what you're engaging in now, but maybe you can say a bit more and then on that question, but also let's not forget about the first set of questions about how do we get civil society and in a sense, complementary, you know, deal not only with government but also get down to the ground. And if Karen and Julie would like to come back on any of these questions, please do. Gilbert.
Maybe I will start, if I may, with the private sector dimension. Right now, as I'm speaking in UNGADA, what we did is to, working with the European Commission, we set up a fund, a private sector fund domestically, i.e. in Uganda, with both few international private sector, but domestic private sector with the European Union and IFAD. And we start with a debt, and progressively, it's a matter of risk management, and progressively now going to equity. So it's not like equity is totally excluded. It's very, very important. Usually you simply want to start with the debt just for being able to bring the private sector first. The heart of the matter, we all know, the simple fact that you talk about agriculture itself is not the most appealing to the private sector, let alone if it's in Africa. When you put agriculture plus Africa together, let's face it, it's seen by the private sector investors as the riskier. It's also the perception. Yesterday I was with a colleague in IFC that was reminding us that globally speaking, agriculture and outside agriculture, if you look at the project in Africa, they are more or less the same pattern as projects elsewhere. But maybe the cost of running those projects in Africa could be different or higher. But the perception in investing in Africa, in agriculture in Africa, increase the risk. So you really have to start with the debt and followed by the equity. The ABC that I referred to, the agribusiness capital that we have, is also the same principle that we said, okay, the first years, I believe we said the first 3 years, we're going to essentially focus on debt, hoping that by the fifth year we could move to equity. So it does happen. The example I will give, even outside what IFA does, There's this Dutch private sector that is also doing it with Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I think in Malawi that we also do have a few examples which I can double check and give you also much more confirmation on that. So it seems to me that that is also linked a little bit to the question on the energy, on the transformation, that dimension that we're talking about. You just cannot look at that in an isolated manner. You have to put a little bit. I do believe that when you look globally, the case in Ethiopia is quite the Ethiopia, the Kenya, and the Rwanda, the Senegal are good cases that create hope when you look at it. Yet it is true that the full conducive environment for the transformation. But our position in IFAD is that we need to start with the basic transformation and hoping that we will get progressively there. The whole issue on the involvement of the civil society into the I will tell you much more involved. It's important maybe to explain how our business model works. You know, when I give the example that the Ugada example that I gave, let me give an example in Zambia. I was there for almost 8 months now in June last year. And first of all, when I arrived in Lusaka, I didn't have a chance even to look at Lusaka. I need to take another flight for 3 hours to go to the northeast Zambia, and then an hour and a half drive before we get to our project. So talking about being at the heart of the community is not going and living in the capital, you know, which is one. Secondly, our model is that I talked about sovereign loan, which means that we make the loan to the government. But before we made that loan, we worked together with the community and the government to build up the project. You see, so the project start, as a matter of fact, the community do put also their money. There's 100% of IFAD project, you have a contribution from the communities. As a matter of principle, it's not a big amount, of course. But as a matter of principle, we have that. So we take, on average, sometimes we will spend a lot of time at the concept level because we want to make sure that we engage with the community, we engage with civil society that is relevant in that community or in that provinces, though the loan end up, it's just like, it's not the community to pay back the loan. That's the difference. It's the government that pays back the loan. It's a sovereign loan. The last point on that is that moving forward, where I see the importance of the civil society being much more on the table is when we prepare our country strategy notes, which we call our COSOP or equivalent of the PRSP or alike. And that's where I do believe that the presence of the civil society is also critical. The point, and I will stop there, the point raised also by the colleague on Ethiopia reminded me also the importance of making clear the complementarity that we see in the commercial approach to agriculture in Africa and the smallholders approach, where we do believe that they are much more complementary, and particularly, you know, keep in mind that 80% of the production in Africa is still coming from smallholders, farmers. It's important to know that, okay, the commercial approach also open up markets and opportunities for training, for addressing the productivity issue, and so forth.
Karen or Julie, do you want to pick up on any of these questions? I'm conscious of time. I will borrow 5 minutes beyond 5 o'clock from all of you guys and gals, with your permission. So we'll run a little bit over. But very briefly, any particular sort of comeback?
Yes, very briefly. I want to say I think I failed terribly because I really wanted to get across the idea that, you know, agricultural science is really important. And none of the questions have come back about agricultural science.
Because you were clear.
So in
accepted.
In framing the response to some of these questions, I really do want to emphasize the agricultural science dimension. And in the work with civil society organizations, a lot of the interaction between farmers and researchers comes mediated through farmers' organizations. They, you know, work jointly in testing new varieties, new technologies. So there's a big role for civil society organizations that are engaged in agriculture in looking at the science and technology continuum. Energy and agriculture. We're seeing a lot of exciting things in solar energy for irrigation, in kind of locally dispersed new kinds of energy, which is easier to get to agriculture and to rural areas than, you know, putting things on the grid. So that's also very exciting. And just very quickly, in terms of equity investment in the food system, I think there's a lot, actually, of local equity investment that's going into the food system. Certainly Latin America, in, you know, East Asia, you're going to see that everywhere. But if the question was really focused on Africa, I mean, look at the milling, look at the beer, look at, you know, all of the, you know, locally processed, affordable items in high demand, there's a lot of equity investment going in there. So certainly there's room for more. And I'm sure it has a science dimension. But
Julie?
Sure, yes, just a couple of points. Yes, thank you very much for your question mark about whether it always makes sense to invest only through the government. I agree with you. You know, I think there are some governments, I think Rwanda is a case, you know, where you could provide a nickel and know exactly what happened to the nickel and what good that it did. But there are very few systems that I've worked with that are that transparent. I think, though, the good news is that we have increasing tools for transparency of investment, and civil society and youth can get better at using those to demand accountability at all levels, at local level, at regional levels, and at national level for investments. So that's one thing. I was in an interesting meeting in Tanzania last year, where we had a wonderful government spokesman stand up and say, you know, here's the national youth and agriculture strategy. It's wonderful. It's all released. You all know about it. A young Tanzanian woman stood up and said, excuse me, I know nothing about your program. Well, perhaps it's because you don't visit the government offices. I visit them regularly. I know nothing about your program, and I don't see it as relevant to me. Well, you know, she was a little impertinent, but, you know, it's no policy about us without our voices included. I think that's what we think of for farmers, but also for youth. Last point on importance of private sector investment, equity investment, and also just the engagement of private sector overall, I think is just absolutely critical. And I think that's the whole attitude about private sector engagement in programs and in development of projects and in co-investing with donors and with other private sector. There's been a huge sea change over the last decade. That was, I think, one of the defining hallmarks of Feed the Future, is to really embed that and say, you know, really we're looking for private sector partners. We're going to try and reduce some of the red tape so it's easier to work with USAID. But look at it not just as one-off. You know, look at sort of what is the big thing that we're trying to do and who can be around the table and what can you contribute. And not just multinationals, not just, you know, we did work with DuPont, we did work with some of the big multinationals. But a lot of investment also went out to create a local private sector company. So a huge issue, of course, is a seed availability. So, and Monsanto and Pioneer and all those are not going to produce the kind of millet seed that we need, or, you know, the kind of African indigenous vegetables that we need. So we need African seed companies, and there's no way except to grow them and provide them finance and nurture them. And really the last thing I'll say, yeah, is it's not just investment. It's not just finance that's needed from private sector. It's mentoring. It's nurturing. It's sort of the creation of local chambers of commerce and Rotary that can be around to nurture young businesses and help see them through their questions.
Thank you, Julie. And the others, let's one more round, very briefly back there. I have a question over here and one more up here. Okay, so three last questions. Thank you. Keep Howard, it short, please.
Very short. Howard Marks, formerly Associate Administrator at the Office of International Cooperation and Development at the Department of Agriculture. and visited Togo during my trips. And it was an amazing project that we sponsored in Cameroon, which brought together the scientists from the University of Maryland Eastern Shore with the Cameroonian agricultural officials to work on roots and tubers, a very successful project, very big in Africa, roots and tubers, as you know, Mr. President. My question is dealing with training, because it seems to me training and extension seem to be, back then and probably still today, is the key to success. And maybe we could talk a little bit about training of trainers, how to use the new technology, considering we have satellites, which we didn't have back then, and so on, to bring this right to the rural areas. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good question on this side, and then we'll come to the last question up front.
Hi. Todd Post from Bread for the World Institute. This is a question for any of the panel. This is specifically about Africa. An acronym, you know, I've been hearing or have, you know, aware of for a long time is CADAP, you know, the agreement that African countries had made that they were going to invest a certain amount in their agricultural sector. I can't remember what it was. I think maybe 7% of GDP or 7% of the national budget. I'm sure these countries are aware, you know, they're aware of their youth bulge and they're aware of their need to create employment. And if it's going to come from the agricultural sector, I guess, that, you know, my question is, how successful are they in living up to the commitments they've made? And you know, I may assume that you're going to say probably not as much as they they should be. What can, you know, what can we do, or is there a way to stimulate more investment in this critical area?
Great. Thank you very much. Please, microphone up here. Josh, right here. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi. My name is Ubshad. I'm from the Hunger Project, and I'm originally from Ethiopia. So I have two questions. The first question is, are we fighting a losing battle against food security, especially in context of doubling population in 2050, and when we consider limited land resources, as well as, you know, El Nino effect that's regularly affecting and limited land resources? The second question is, when we talk about food security, I believe it's really important to talk about nutrition security as well. Because while we are trying to address food issue, you know, we are getting into double burden. So how is IFAD is trying to address those issues?
Thank you very much. Now, I'll go back in reverse order. Julie first, Karen, and then last word for Gilbert. Pick up on one or more of the questions very briefly, and maybe leave with us sort of your one last thought that you'd like us to take away from this discussion and mull over as we maybe continue discussion outside in the reception. Julie.
I think we need another session to talk about what food security is.
Okay.
That's one thing. Maybe just if I could say about the training and extension and training of trainers. What we found out when we were designing this project and sitting with private sector and sitting with youth is that the training needs that were expressed were completely different from what we expected. In fact, the private sector said, you know, you're used to training agriculture, you're used to training enterprise, you know, for youth. De-emphasize that. We can actually do a lot of that ourselves. What we really need are youth who are disciplined, who know how to set priorities, who know how to communicate, and can work, you know, and I think it's very consistent with what's evolving here. You know, the labor market is changing. We're all beginning, and youth more than anyone, to operate in the gig economy. You need a different set of soft skills to function in that, and it's no different in these emerging markets. So I think, you know, my takeaway is listen first to what really seems to be needed. Don't assume that you already know. And I think that's also part of the scaling process, right, is that be open to iterate and try, yeah, and to fail, right? I think that's a big lesson for all of us is that one of the reasons that scale-up hasn't taken off yet is because the incentives of donor organizations and governments are, whatever you do, don't admit that you weren't successful, right? So claim success. As a result, everything is successful, but it's really not. It's really not. So how do we get to a place where you all, the constituency, you know, for and taxpayers, you know, for kind of development, demand something different, like shareholders demand from private sector, right? We want a different kind of investment. We want something. We want different kinds of indicators. We want to see how you're partnering with others.
Thank you. Karen.
I'm going to jump on the question about CADAP and investment in agriculture. The Comprehensive African Agricultural Development Program was adopted in 2003. I had its 10-year anniversary, actually 15-year anniversary. A few of the countries have met the commitment, which was to put 10% of their national budgets into agricultural public expenditure, mostly on the investment side. But the issue is not so much whether they met the 10%. That was always a very questionable commitment and objective. It's the composition of that investment. It's what are they spending that money on? It's not just the quantity. And that allows me to come back to my concerns about science. The longer-term payoff from that investment in agriculture will come from building the scientific foundations for modern dynamic agriculture. Too many of the countries took even an increased commitment of spending in agriculture and put it in short-term things, rehabilitating irrigation schemes that had been rehabilitated already five times and already need rehabilitation again. Fertilizer subsidies, the things that kind of make a short-term splash but don't move the needle in the long run, and we really need a focus and an understanding on how to address these long-run issues.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question about science.
Great. Gilbert, the one question we haven't addressed is the losing battle. Maybe you're the right person to hopefully reassure us that it's a winning battle. So,
no,
but there may be other points you want to raise.
So. I'm not so sure I'm the right person, because I'm always optimistic guy. So I don't think that we are losing the battle. Though last year the report from the FAO, IFA, WFP, UNICEF, WHO, on the state of food security and nutrition in the world, the results were not encouraging, because for the first time in the 10 years, it has been picking up in terms of food insecurity, which put all of us in a sad mood. Globally, still, that I believe all of that being said, and though we have to recognize the progress. The question is that, is the progress sustainable enough? Is it strong enough? When you compare that to the population growth that Karen and Julie touched on at the very beginning, this is where is my concern for Africa alone. Every year, according to the ILO statistics, every year we have 12 million youngsters that are joining the labor market. Are we having enough progress to be able, or the gap is widening? That's where, but to on absolute term, I refuse to accept that we are losing the battle. That one is very clear in my mind. I also cannot help it. On one hand, to be quite frankly, I agree with Karen. On the flip side, my former hat of Prime Minister also comes to play, that the 10% cut up, yes, it's true. As I said, 100% agree with that. But it does raise another challenge when you in mostly the low-income countries, when you're, I wouldn't say your short-term priorities compared to the long-term. I would say your short-term, like, I don't have the choice. Because when you have your people or you have the farmers start going to the streets because the price of the fertilizer is deemed too high, you almost have no choice than making sure the subsidy is enough for them to be able to have access to it. Then, obviously, sometimes you make the decision knowing that it's not the wisest decision, honestly speaking. So this is another debate that I would be interested in. My last my last point, I remember I was challenging. Right now, I believe we only have 8 countries that are meeting the Maputo Declaration, the latest that scorecard that Bill and Melinda Gates and others put together. But You know, we also have a challenge of data, making sure that we can also have the data on the different segment that, you know, it sometimes seems to me that one country to another, the way the data is being put together to know whether the percentage is a little bit doubtful. And maybe I will, or the training, you're so right. What IFAD is really pushing for is also bringing in the farmers' organization. To use through the farmers' organization, it's easier to be able to have the appropriate assess what is the need, and you're fully right, and making sure that you can maximize the impact at the training level.
Thank you very much. What I take away from this, I borrow one more half a minute, thinking, so what do I understand now, having listened to this, to what is smart investment? I think it's starting with Gilbert. It's gender smart, it's environmentally and climate smart, it's nutrition smart, and very importantly, and we didn't pursue it perhaps as far as we can do next year when we come back to this, youth smart. But it's also linking rural-urban. It's not only agriculture, it's also off-farm, of course, investment in off-farm. It's very much linking public-private and drawing in the private investors, hopefully increasingly also with the equity. It's scientifically smart, but actually I would say it's evidence-based in addition to sort of the narrow, maybe I misunderstood you. It's not just science in the narrow sense. I think we need to have good evidence, which goes back to the data. And by the way, IFAD does very well on collecting evidence, and if you want to talk to Paul Winters, who sits in front and is sort of in charge of evidence-based, grab him in the in the corridor, because IFAD really does well on this score. And finally, two important, to me, important points. One is scale-up smart. In other words, we're not just sticking to the one project. We actually think long-term and what is the trajectory after the project. And we, and I think Gilbert reminded us, politically smart. Because if we can't sell whatever we have to offer to the people, to the farmers, to the people, then forget it. So we have to listen and be politically really smart in how we sell the solutions that maybe hopefully are science-based and evidence-based, but we have to be able to sell them. So that to me is what I take away from this wonderful discussion. And please, let's all thank you for your questions and the panel.